even at 20, 30, 40, 50 times, even sometimes 100 times ARR, the outcomes that we've seen in the market are big enough that sometimes it's very much justified.
I'm Scott McGrew. Welcome to Sand Hill Road.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Mary D'Onofrio is partner at a very old firm with a very big fund at a very young age.
I don't know if you know too much about Bessemer, but we're a 100-year-old fund, the oldest in the United States, actually. Started out of the Carnegie Steel money.
The Bessemer.
I know, exactly. So they licensed the Bessemer process and made their fortune that way, Andrew Carnegie and Henry Phipps. And Henry Phipps then started Bessemer Securities, Bessemer Trust, and Bessemer Venture Partners spun out of it in the 80s. We're on our... BVP 11, $2.5 billion fund. And 4 years ago, decided to really become a multi-stage fund rather than doing just seed Series A and kind of early Series B. And so I lead net new investments Series B and beyond, and also help some of our enduring portfolio companies like Auth0, Twilio, and the like that we support throughout their life cycles. And since then, we've raised two dedicated growth vehicles, totaling $1.3 billion. So a lot of money to help entrepreneurs with. I focus more so than anything in developer tooling, companies like LaunchDarkly, HashiCorp, which recently filed, Zapier, data infrastructure, companies like Big ID or Imply Data. But technically, I'm a generalist within software and cloud software specifically. And in a prior life, I was actually an investment banker at Morgan Stanley.
A prior life, but you're not very old, because I happen to know you've won the 30 under 30 award, right?
Thank you.
So therefore, you must be under 30.
I am 29. I guess
just squeaked by.
Yes, I did. I guess what I mean by that is it feels like a long time ago. It was about 7 years ago. So nonetheless, it has been a while. But the jobs were somewhat connected. I actually did private capital markets while at Morgan Stanley. So that was raising money for private technology companies. Some of the transactions I worked on were companies like Uber and Airbnb and Forescout. And that was their private capital raise like pre-IPO effectively. So in some respects, the sell side of the job I have today.
So I don't want to sound in any way patronizing, but you've done all this under the age of 30. I mean, I realize you have an MBA from Yale. I mean, you are well qualified to be doing this, but that's a hell of an accomplishment.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you. I think it was a combination of the right skill set, you know, bringing some more financial and quantitative skills to bear than early stage investing requires, with also being at the right place at the right time. You know, there aren't too many opportunities to build a new practice in a very longstanding fund. And my partner today, at the time, not my partner, my supervisor, Byron Dieter, hired me to start the growth practice 4 years ago. And since then, we've built it, including my partner, Elliot Robinson, who co-leads the practice with me today. It's a fantastic group of people. But certainly, I agree with you, somewhat forward-leaning to entrust it to someone who was relatively new in their career.
How much money do you directly touch? That you have some,
a lot. Well, you know, total Bessemer in the current set of funds probably has a total, I think, of $3.5 billion.
Okay.
And the growth funds themselves are $1.3 billion, but then we still do invest some out of the main funds. So it's a good amount. The great thing is we have something called the Century Committee and the Century Fund, where we evaluate a lot of the growth stage opportunities as a collective. And so I'm part of that group. But almost any growth stage opportunity, especially into our existing portfolio, I will touch in some way.
One of your first professional jobs was at the U.S. Treasury. So in some ways, you're dealing with less money.
Actually, ironically, I worked for the Treasurer of the United States, Rosie Rios, who is now a board member in one of my portfolio companies, Get Insured, which is very cool. But she actually ran the Bureau of Engraving and Printing in United States Mint. So she literally minted money.
and signed every one of them.
I think her signature is on like over $1 trillion of US currency.
Did you know that like for, I don't know how many decades, it's always been a woman? The first U.S. Treasury Secretary is Janet Yellen. But it's always been a woman who's been in charge, and it's the second signature on the dollar.
It's the Treasury Secretary and the Treasury of the United States.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's cool. Just it fun trivia.
Very cool. And she was there for 8 years.
The other thing you need to know about Mary is she indexes, quantifies, organizes, and calibrates all kinds of things, and she's damn good at it. Like the Cloud 100 list, which she works on in partnership with Forbes.
So the Cloud 100 2021 list is worth an aggregate of $518 billion. It was $267 billion in 2020, last year. How much of that is the cloud gaining in value, and how much of that just feels a little bit bubbly?
So I definitely say it's a combination of the two. I think the run-up in the public cloud markets, combined with a lot of the fantastic exits that we've seen, the likes of Snowflake and Cloudflare and Auth0 even in the M&A side, has led to just vast interest in cloud, investor appreciation for what those companies could become. And what's remarkable is in the public cloud market, the average revenue growth rate is actually 40%. And that's at scale, at maturity. And then you have some companies that are even defying that, like Shopify, that's growing over 100% at $3 billion of revenue. So I think as it trickles down into the private markets, investors realize that their willingnesses to pay historically were actually lower than they should have been, considering what these companies can become. That being said, in the most recent Cloud 100 list, the average revenue multiple, or ARR multiple, pardon me, was 34 times. And in 2016, it was 9 times. So there's been a huge run-up in multiples, and growth rates have not been at that same level. So investors are actually willing to pay more now for the same levels of growth than they have been historically. I think that for some companies, it's going to be totally justified. Beneficiaries, especially during COVID, were infrastructure companies, collaboration and productivity software companies. But certainly we're going to see some companies not live up to those fantastic expectations when, you know, I'm sure you hear lots of narratives around this, but investors are paying 200, 300 times ARR for lots of companies. Not every cloud company is going to be a deck of corn.
And the average value of the companies in the list of 100 companies is $5.2 billion. I mean, there was a time when we thought a billion-dollar company was remarkable.
Certainly. And, you know, I think, especially if we look at the top 10 or 20 companies there, you know, you really see the power of the cloud. This year, it was Stripe, Databricks, Checkout, Plaid, Figma, and the like. And so, you know, seeing those companies justify those massive valuations is certainly true. I think as you look further down the list, and then even some that didn't make the list, you know, are they all going to be $10 billion companies? I'm not exactly sure. But I think that especially COVID and the tailwinds behind cloud expansion have opened up a lot of opportunity for cloud companies to capture. You know, when we were doing the State of the Cloud the year before COVID, so I think it was actually 2020, we estimated that cloud penetration of software alone was 25%. And that assumes no software TAM expansion. So if you if you assume that the software market has increased and COVID tailwinds have propelled cloud, you know, there is an ample amount of market opportunity for them to capture. But I agree with you. I'm not sure every single one of them is going to be exiting for 10 or 20 billion.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
You clearly like metrics.
Yeah.
You like measuring things. You've got the Cloud 100, the Bessemer Cash Conversion Score, that's you. The Scaling to 100 report, that's you. You help create a NASDAQ index and an ETF, right? Do you just measure things all the time? I mean, I'm talking about like your personal life. Have you got indexes and whiteboards and?
I think I probably over rotate on metrics and measurement in my professional life, which leads my personal life to be unmeasured. leave that to my husband.
Fair enough. If we set COVID aside, your experience in banking and venture capital has been entirely during boom times. Does that worry you at all? I mean, you are, like I said, incredibly intelligent, incredibly well-educated, incredibly well-respected in the industry. But your entire professional experience has been up and to the right as far as the economy goes.
Well, so I hear what you're saying. However, I think it comes down to investment philosophy and kind of how you, especially as a growth investor, how I evaluate companies. I think in the current environment of high prices and momentum investing, people will discount from what they think the best case scenario is for a company to get to their willingness to pay. I am more of a fundamentals investor. I do look at metrics very closely on a historic basis. And I'll also model companies into what I think fundamentals should look like in the future and use historical multiples, historic outcomes in order to base those decisions, which, you know, applies a lot of discipline to my investing philosophy and my willingness to pay that to some extent, and I will acknowledge this, to some extent makes it difficult to play in the current environment. You know, if your willingness to pay is, you know, 30 times ARR, but the market demands 100 times, then, okay, you have to sit that one out. So I think for me, it has resulted in fewer but higher conviction bets. But I certainly agree with you that I have not seen a downturn like the early 2000s that others have that give them potentially even more pause. But I think that so long as I stay true to that investing framework, I feel good about the bets I've made. But you're right. Timing the market is part of that calculus. I don't think we're going to see software investments that are, high-flying 100% growers that are offered at 10 times anymore. You know, Bessemer published some of its memos, and I think we led the Shopify's earliest round at like 5 times ARR. You're not going to get those deals anymore. They just don't exist. But even at 20, 30, 40, 50 times, even sometimes 100 times ARR, if markets are big enough, you have the execution chops and you have some competitive advantage, whether it's on distribution, product, team, execution, the outcomes that we've seen in the market are big enough that sometimes it's very much justified. So I wouldn't say we're sitting it out entirely. It's fewer higher conviction bets.
Speaking of timing, you've got this situation with a lot of money going into infrastructure soon. There are a lot of opportunities for companies in your portfolio.
Certainly. And I think that they're capitalizing on that, seeing the investment there and wanting to certainly capitalize on it.
Looking back at your time over both banking and venture capital, what's the mistake you wish you could take back?
This is not really a mistake, but maybe I'll answer it a different way of like an assumption I made that was wrong is I made the assumption, especially when I was thinking about doing venture, that everyone would want my money. That like, as an investor, you know, companies are coming down Sand Hill Road knocking on your door and just, you know, saying, oh, please pick me, please pick me. And, you know, you have the power of choice. I think the way that the market has evolved in venture and certainly on the growth side is that, capital has increasingly become a commodity, and you need to figure out your personal approach to companies, markets, and even your role on the board, such that you can build a reputation, build a brand, and obviously work at a firm that has the same, in order to win deals and to have access to them. So a little bit of a different question than you asked, or answered a different question than you asked. But I think that was an assumption that I made that was incorrect.
It seems like a reasonable assumption, right? I've got access to a large bank account. I can put a signature on a check. People will flock to me.
Well, some of my partners who have actually been at Bessemer longer than I've been alive tell me that, you know, it used to be a situation where that would be the case. You know, people would come down Sand Hill Road and go door to door and be like, hey, there are not too many firms, not too many people who are doing this, taking bets on risky early stage companies and college dropouts who have a big idea. And, you know, we were talking about it in terms of the Cloud 100, but there have been so many successful outcomes of that model that,
yes.
You know, the capital into venture as of late is astounding. In our most recent State of the Cloud, we noted that $288 billion of venture dollars went into the industry in only the first half of 2021 alone. And the second quarter, I don't have the third quarter stats off the top of my head, but the second quarter, it was like $156 billion. It's astounding.
It is another example of you are making your career at an interesting time in which there's this sudden flood of capital.
Yeah. No, totally. And you know, your firms are competing to help companies build,
which is great.
Yeah,
this is also a time in which the average person in America may see technology and big tech in a negative light. I would guess that the average person in America who has an opinion on that probably does not know a ton about venture capital, but it would be unfair, I think, to loop in venture capital with the evils of big tech. I mean, there is some evil out there, right? But venture capital continues to either not be understood by Washington and the average American, or I think justifiably can be explained as something good that still helps the world move forward with projects that will change the world.
I think you're right. And, you know, even as I think of my own personal portfolio, you know, I think these companies are helping to make the world a better place in their ways. You know, I'm invested in a company called Forter. It's fraud prevention software companies. They have customers like Nordstrom. Like, let's help Nordstrom not be overcome by fraudsters. You know, I'm invested in a company called Big ID. It literally is a data privacy company, data infrastructure in order to preserve, you know, consumers' rights and privileges under different data privacy laws like GDPR, CCPA. And venture dollars are the ones that fund those companies, fund those new ideas. I certainly think there's more goodness than anything there.
You are a young woman who is in charge at a very important Silicon Valley venture firm. Are you a sign that we have solved that problem in venture, or are you an outlier?
I think that I'm a sign that there is a lot of progress. I don't think that it has been solved. I think that, you know, there are many, many boards, many venture firms that still do not have as much female representation as they should. You know, theoretically, female representation in venture firms and boards should rival population statistics, right? It should be about 50-50. It's not quite there. That being said, there are more and more of us. And on the portfolio side, I certainly do advocate for my portfolio companies to start hiring chief people officers, chief human resource officers, such that diversity and inclusion at the portfolio company level, at the board level, will improve over time. And you know, obviously, there aren't just moral imperatives for D&I, but they produce better business outcomes, having more perspectives and more people with different perspectives attacking the same problem. So I think I'm certainly a sign that there's progress, more to be made, but I'm very proud that the Bessemer growth team is exceptionally diverse. And I am very actively involved in communities like All Raise and even kind of women's mentorship initiatives at Bessemer, because I'm hoping to help the next generation of female investing partners to rise to that level as well.
We were talking earlier about how you have all of these different measurements that you've invented and numbering systems and ranking systems. What appeals to you with that? What, on a visceral level, what is that the thing that fires neurons in your brain that light up happy spots in your head?
Well, I think the entire discipline of venture is trying to identify what those foundational and transformational companies could be that will change the next generation of the way that we think and live and work. And while not all of that can be boiled down to numbers, especially at the growth stage, those are really good signals. And I like to use metrics and numbers more as guides for places to look. So for example, with CAC payback, customer acquisition cost payback, the rate at which your sales and marketing expense is repaid by an individual customer, if it's really high, that can tell me that, you know, it's not important just, hey, CAC payback's high. It's, hey, CAC payback's high. Does that mean that this is a really tough market? Like that customers don't actually really want your product, or competition is really fierce? Is that it? Or is CAC payback totally justified because your customer lifetime values, the kind of total amount of money that your individual customer will give you over time, are those just so high that it justifies that? It more points me in the places to look for the next level of diligence. I'm never going to invest in a company simply because they have good or bad, or not invest in a company because they have bad metrics. But I love to use the numbers as signals for where to pry.
Mary D'Onofrio, partner at Bessemer Venture Partners, where she created the firm's growth investment practice. This is the second time we visited Bessemer. The first was back in 2019, talking with Tess Hatch, an aerospace engineer who focuses her investments on space and aeronautics.
There's this famous quote, an astronaut said that the first day we were all pointing to our countries, the second or third we were pointing to our continents, and by the fourth it was just one world. And I think that's important just not for me, but for everyone to experience.
Look for that interview in our library of interviews with venture capitalists wherever you find your podcasts. Sandhill Road is produced by Sean Myers under the leadership of Sarah Bueno and Stephanie Adruni. For more interviews with Silicon Valley's most influential entrepreneurs, check me out on TV at Press Here. That's Sunday mornings on NBC Bay Area and everywhere in the world on iTunes and at PressHereTV.com.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.